You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, February 15th, 2007. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Evan Bernstein.
Hi, all.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Perry DeAngelis.
Steve, is it true that while we're locked away in icy New England, you are, in fact, sunning yourself in Florida?
That is correct. The weather's been just okay, but it's still a lot better than getting blanketed with ice and snow.
A little better than our ice storm.
Right, right. Yeah. It's been quite fun. Yeah.
I bleed for you.
It's no Oswego, New York. Let's just put it that
Steve,
way.
Steve, I heard from a little bird that you went to Kennedy Space Center.
Yeah, I blogged about that today. I went to the Kennedy Space Center. It's pretty close to where we're vacationing.
Do they have a diaper exhibit?
No, they're pretty. They keep that under wraps.
Inappropriate. Yeah.
Rebecca, I have to say that for the scientific women movement, that was an embarrassing episode.
Oh, whatever. The men have had plenty.
You're talking about the female astronaut who went psychotic?
Yes.
It's got nothing to do with whether or not she's an astronaut, though. She just happens to be a freak who wears diapers.
She just got a little case of space madness. She's fine. She'll be all right.
In case you don't know, it's a love triangle. She was in love with an astronaut, some other one. And the point is she drove from Houston to Florida, and she felt like she had to get there quickly, so she put on space diapers that they wear in outer space so she wouldn't have to pull over to pee.
Wait, they were space diapers?
Well, whatever. You know, the stuff they wear on the ships.
I don't think they were space diapers. I thought they were just regular Depends or something.
It's what they wear on the shuttle.
Really?
Yeah. I'm sure that there's something a little bit more tricked out about them than just Depends.
Rebecca, you can't have free-floating feces on the space shuttle.
That's disgusting.
Very dangerous.
Thank you.
I'm just saying, you know. Now, Stephen, did we interrupt you?
Not at all. But if you've never been to the Kennedy Space Center, it is a great tourist attraction. It's a good trip. The best part, hands down,
was the Saturn V
rocket.
That is jaw-dropping.
It is enormous. You just can't imagine how big it is until you're standing underneath it and you see the whole thing.
That's the second biggest rocket I've ever seen.
I had a similar reaction seeing that in Florida as seeing David in Florence. I mean, it was incredible. The jaw just dropped.
The other thing I observed in my blog was the fact that the tourist attraction is all about people in space. You know, we talked about that on this podcast before, about the debate between how much money and effort should NASA be putting into sending people into space versus, you know, sending robotic or unmanned missions. And there's, you know, reasonable points we made on both sides. Certainly, it's more cost-effective and efficient to send robots than people, but there are certain, you know, both romantic and cultural and other reasons to send people into space. But from NASA's point of view, at least what they are showcasing to the public, it is all about people in space. It was about the Apollo program. You know, the International Space Station is all about having a permanent human presence in space, and now all the buzz is about going back to the moon and going to Mars.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Because that's where the glory is.
Yeah,
it really is. There's no greater success than that Apollo program.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when Kennedy made that challenge and we did it by 69, just no, you know, it was awesome.
Yeah, they still talk about that as the greatest human adventure, going to the moon. Oh.
I think culturally, space exploration is not only an absolute requirement, but it's really good. It's good for. I remember thinking of the space program when I was a kid, and I was fascinated by it. I mean, it shaped part of my youth, like Star Wars did, you know? It had the same kind of effect, except it was real.
That's right.
Maybe it's our age, but the shuttle program just never – maybe it was because of the accident. I don't know. But the shuttle program just never did it the way going to the moon did.
It never met the expectations. I mean, it was supposed to – the flights were supposed to be much more frequent and routine, and it never really lived up
much
to those expectations.
Yep.
And then, yeah, much less expensive and more efficient, and now it's actually lived longer than its life expectancy. They're definitely going to be shutting it down by 2010. They just have to finish the space station. I think there's going to be one Hubble repair trip, and then 2010, the space shuttle program will shut down. And then by 2040, they're planning on the next shuttle is going to be coming online in 2014, so it's going to be a four-year gap. And interestingly, what I learned is that there's a lot of things they have to do that they can't do until they actually end the shuttle program. Like, they have to retool a lot of the buildings, but they need to keep them up and running for this for the shuttle. So,
infrastructure.
Yeah, so they really can't do a lot of stuff until they actually totally shut down the shuttle program, which is interesting.
Also, Steve, do you remember driving by the shuttle complex where they wheel the shuttle in to do repairs? That thing was that
gigantic.
Structure was gargantuan.
Well, that structure was sized for the Saturn V, 36 stories tall. The shuttle, you can actually, the shuttle was in that building, the vehicle assembly building, the VAB, when we were down on the tour.
Oh, cool.
It's only about half the height of the Saturn V. So it looks small in that building. Of course, the shuttle itself is huge in and of itself, but it is dwarfed by the Saturn V.
You know, there's been a lot about NASA in the news lately because of that thing with the woman. But it was very interesting. I saw Homer Hickam be interviewed, the kid that October Sky was about.
Mm-hmm.
If you've ever saw that movie.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to train astronauts. And one thing he said that really caught my attention was that the simple fact is there's too many astronauts. They put too many people into the program with not enough flights. So he said the competition is so fierce that it's literally unhealthy.
Really? Wow. Interesting.
He said there's simply too many astronauts and not enough seats.
That's got to really bite if you were selected. You're already an accomplished pilot, probably.
Yep.
You go through the training, you do the whole thing, and you're just warming a bench somewhere, just waiting.
You can't
get
a flight.
That's a nightmare.
Yeah.
And you know that at the very least, you got this four-year hiatus coming up.
Yeah.
Although I think they're going to keep people in the space station during this period of time. I guess they're just going to be using Russian rockets to get up there.
Nice.
Yes. Yeah.
You can still go to the bar and tell chicks that you're an astronaut and.
Yeah.
You know,
does that work?
Right. Works for me.
The astronauts, again, the culture of NASA is that the astronauts are the rock stars. They're the show.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Rebecca, you shouldn't have said that. Now you're going to get tons of emails. Hey, I'm an astronaut.
Steve, did they mention the space truck at all?
You're talking about the Orion, the one that would shuttle from the Earth to the Moon?
Right, exactly.
Yeah. They just mentioned it in passing. They don't have a lot, I guess, to show about that yet.
Mm. Steve, did they talk much about the movie Spaceballs?
I must have missed that part of the tour.
Going to Mars would be so cool.
Yeah.
Awesome.
I mean, that would be majestic.
It's inevitable.
It doesn't look good for near term, though. Did you read that article in Scientific American saying that pretty much the radiation to deflect or deal with the radiation that they would encounter on that trip is almost insurmountable
with
near
term
technology? That
really?
Was really a depressing article to read.
It's too bad.
It's a major technological hurdle, but you know it's not impassable. Let's go on. We have actually a lot of news this week. Let's go on to the first news item. This one is about these parents in Oregon. Oregon, the United States, whose 13-year-old daughter has probably has a brain tumor. Now, the full story on this is that she was born with a very severe form of brain tumor called glioblastoma multiforme. She had four surgeries to remove this tumor. This is a type of brain cancer. It grew back each time. The fourth time, she had a prolonged remission where it did not grow back, and now, you know, over years, and now she's 13 years old. Unfortunately, a CAT scan shows that she has a mass in her brain, which is almost certainly a recurrence of brain cancer. The doctors are recommending that it's immediately removed again. Now, her parents, I wasn't quite sure by the way the articles were written, either just before or just after the fourth surgery, they took her to a psychic healer, a self-proclaimed psychic healer, Nikolai Levashov. Now, he quote-unquote treated her around the time of her fourth surgery. He claims that he could sort of psychically reach in there and alter the cells so that they become non-cancerous. And, of course, even though she had multiple surgeries, the parents credit the psychic with her prolonged remission.
Of course.
That guy's good, huh?
In that part of it, Steve, I did spot one logical fallacy where...
Just
it,
one?
It stayed, well, in that one section I'm talking about, it said that it wasn't until being treated by an alternative healer that her cancer went to remission, which is pretty much a classic post hoc ergo propter hoc, which is basically A precedes B, therefore A caused B.
Actually, the story also says that earlier on, after the first surgery, they treated her with a banned alternative treatment called Chondriana, which is actually a concoction of cells. And the mother thinks that it worked because the tumor grew back slower than they thought it would have.
At least initially. Then it reached its full size again after
that. So, I mean, no matter what happens, they'll think it works.
Right.
Now but her cancer came back now, but they still think that the psychic magically cured her. But now, get this. So now Levashov tells the parents, actually, what I was going to say before, as he treated her for a period of time, then he completed his treatment over the telephone. So this guy was literally phoning it in.
I wonder what they were paying him, by the way.
Now he's telling the parents that this growth on the CAT scan is not cancer. It's new brain tissue, new, like, normal, healthy brain tissue.
Oh.
And this is now just part of the miracle of his treatment, that her brain is regenerating. So they're not going to have it removed.
So the parents are not going to have this new healthy tissue removed.
Right. They're
going to leave it in there.
That's right, based upon the opinions of this psychic, alleged psychic.
When this girl dies, do you think that the parents should be prosecuted?
So this is, well, first of all, I hope that this girl survives whatever is going on. I mean, obviously, I don't wish anything bad on this 13-year-old.
Not if her parents don't let her have the surgery.
She's totally innocent. In this whole situation, she, of course, is the ultimate victim of all of this.
Of course.
Now, I'm more interested in whether or not the state has the right to force the parents to allow the treatment than what to do, you know, criminally if a negative outcome occurs. But they're basically both part of the same question. And this is a very interesting question. I've been investigating this, you know, in preparation for this piece. Now, of course, the basic laws in the United States, I think in most civilized countries, is that parents have a duty to care for their children. And if you fail to give them the, you know, basic necessities of life, like basic medical care, that's considered neglect. If you actively do anything to harm your kids, that's abuse, right? So parents can be, children can be taken away from parents for neglect and abuse, and parents can be criminally charged for neglect and abuse. However, in the United States, 41 of the 50 states have religious exemption laws, which basically protect parents from any kind of prosecution for neglect or abuse if their behavior was part of their religious belief.
Mm-hmm.
Their religion.
That's a shame.
Right. Now, a lot of those laws are motivated by the anti-vaccination crowd. So a lot of times these laws are put on the books because people don't want to vaccinate their kids, and they don't want to be, you know, sued or prosecuted for neglect or negligence because they're not having their kids vaccinated. And some states, it's a little different in every state. Some states will have the religious exemption, but then they have some wiggle room in there so that if the child's life or health is immediately threatened, the parents still have to do something. You know, they can't.
Who judges that?
Well, it's up to the state to decide if they want to prosecute, if they want to do anything about it. And most of the time, they don't.
Yeah, the local DA.
Yeah, a few high-profile cases where they have, and it's really their discretion. But this is, you know, this is really a total scandal. It's one of those issues that I think if you asked 100 people in the street, most people would not really know what the situation is. Most people would not think that parents can basically allow their kids to die from lack of medical care and are protected from any kind of action because of a law that specifically protects them, as long as they claim that this is part of their religion. So, I mean, this is, you know, very anti-child, in my opinion. This is absolutely scandalous, and it's sort of got through these local legislatures under the radar in most cases. And I don't think that there's been a really appropriate public debate about this. And the bottom line is, parents can abuse and neglect their kids as long as they have some wacky belief to justify it. Now, in this case, the wrinkle is, you know, should we consider the, you know, trusting this Russian psychic as a religious belief? How is this the parents' religion?
That's a big question. Yeah. Yep.
Mm-hmm. So even if we accept the line, Oregon actually has one of the strongest religious exemption laws. So this is like the worst state for this to happen in, from the perspective of, you know, doing what's right and from the child's life. Even in Oregon, you have to ask the question, trusting in a psychic, how is that fall under the religious exemption.
Yeah.
A spokesperson for the Department of Human Services in Oregon, Patricia Feeney, is quoted as saying in this article, "Ultimately, the care of a child is up to the parents. It's the same laws that apply to immunization. If people have religious reasons for not doing it, they don't have to." So that is the approach that they're taking to this case. And the bottom line is this poor 13-year-old girl who, you know, could, you know, have a significant benefit from standard medical intervention in this case, is going to be deprived of that because her parents are wackos.
It's criminal.
You know, in my opinion, you have to be really wacky to put the well-being of your kid like in the hands of a psychic. There has to be a real malfunction. What's wrong with these? Like, the question really to me is, what's wrong with these people?
Well, to some extent, I mean, I don't give the parents a pass. This is their duty. This is their job to make a reasonable decision for their child. And this decision is grossly, you know, wrong in my opinion. But they are partially victims as well. They are, you know, obviously I'm a parent, as I've spoken about before on this show, and I completely understand how totally devastating it would be to have a child who was seriously ill. So I do sort of sympathize with the parents on that score. And you would definitely want to cling for any hope. Now, your average person who is not medically trained or scientifically trained, not skeptically inclined, has a child with a very severe, serious medical illness. You know, the mother talks about in the article that they basically had given up hope. Sure, you know, they're going to grasp for anything, any hope, no matter how flimsy it is.
Yeah, but they're turning away real medicine.
Yeah, I mean, so initially, at least they were doing what the doctors told her, and they were doing extra stuff. You know, it's one thing to get the surgery and then also have the psychic wave their hands over you. I mean, I don't think that that's necessary, but at least it's not harmful. But now it's totally different. Now they are ignoring the direct advice of their physicians, and they're believing this, you know, really incredibly ludicrous claim that's being made by the psychic. But Levashov, he's the villain in this story. This guy is lining his pockets by giving advice to these parents that is likely going to result in either, you know, the severe morbidity or the death of this 13-year-old girl.
Steve, and it's not just him. I think it's also the state legislature that's also, you know, villainous in this, case.
I agree. They are totally failing this child. They are utterly failing this child.
Well, if let's say a doctor makes a bad prognosis, right? That doctor screws up somehow. The doctor can get legally charged for this. Could ultimately lose their license to practice.
Malpractice.
I think that if this guy, this psychic, wants to enter that arena, then he should be held accountable if this kid dies.
Now, Jay, 20 years ago, what you're saying is right, and that's what would have happened. You know, this guy could get criminally charged with practicing medicine without a license, and he could be held liable for, you know, a negative outcome here. But the culture, at least in this country, in the last 20 years, has changed to such a degree that you could do this and totally get a free pass, completely get away with it. Now, the parents aren't going to sue this guy. If the parents, you know, if say something bad happens to the girl and the parents turned around and sued this guy, they would have a case. But that just never happens. Because then the parents would have to accept their own responsibility.
Right.
And the fact that they were totally fooled, and that just never happens in my experience.
They'd be more likely to sue the doctors, the medical doctors.
There's never a case where a parent then looks at the corpse of their child and says, gee, maybe what I did, you know, was utterly wrong, and now I'm angry at this guy even though I followed him like a boob.
They will think, I think, that medicine failed us, and because of this nice psychic, we got more years out of her than we would have otherwise.
Yeah, Perry, as I said, in my experience, I've never seen it happen. You can't prove a negative. I don't know that it's never happened anywhere. But, you know, being involved actively in this arena, it's in fact trying to go after specific, you know, charlatans at where you have lawyers and prosecutors trying to find somebody, some victim who's willing to sue them. It's just, it's almost impossible to do. That's what I'm saying.
It would be really, really cool if Randy went after this guy.
Well, I think that, I agree. I think that we should all go after this guy, the Levashov. And I also think that, you know, the public needs to be aware that this is the legal state of affairs and that children are really not being protected. And I would, you know, look find out what the laws are in your state, in your country, and if they don't make any sense, write a letter to your representative. And, you know, this needs to be, we need to have a public debate on this issue, because right now the laws are completely, completely broken, in my opinion.
Steve, I'm reading through the current comments in related to this article. There are quite a few of them. I'd say at least half of them are applauding the parents and their decision to have the courage to do what they're doing.
That's right. It's very polarized. Half are the parents are wonderful, spiritual, this is great, and don't listen to the naysayers. The other half are, oh my God, you're killing your kid. You know, so there's really, there's no real room for moderation in this issue.
Right.
You think that they're either saviors and are courageous, or that they are, you know, negligent parents who are listening to a charlatan and are putting their kid, this innocent, you know, 13-year-old girl, at totally unnecessary risk. There's really no middle ground, you know, between those two extremes. And that, and the comments reflect that.
Steve, I got one more quick comment. Doesn't the fact that this mass, in this new mass in her brain, doesn't the fact that it was identified as a mass, doesn't that preclude the fact that, that it could be normal brain tissue?
Now, I am not privy to the details of this case, but speaking generally, Bob, you're absolutely correct. If the surgeons or the neurosurgeons who are taking care of her, after having looked at the image, saying this is almost definitely cancer, we need to take it out, then it's likely that it has characteristics on the CAT scan which make it clear that it's a tumor,
and or at the very least, not brain tissue.
So, if it were a tumor, then it would look very different from normal healthy brain tissue on imaging. It would not be a tough call to make. So, and it's, so you're probably correct.
The parents have obviously bought in to whatever the psychic is telling them. They're done.
It's unfortunate. Sad case.
They sold their souls.
Their faith is trumping everything else.
Got to keep an eye on this one, see what happens.
Well, the next news item is a bit of good news. We've been following the plight of the teaching of evolution in Kansas, that lovely state.
Did they actually get around to teaching evolution in Kansas?
It just seems
like they're in perpetual discussion and controversy over this thing.
Well, it's the fifth set of science standards in 8 years.
That's right. So the State Board of Education approved new evolution-friendly science standards with a 6-4 vote. So it was close, you know.
6-4.
Overwhelming, 60%.
There's certainly proof of devolution.
The previous standards, you know, brought into question, you know, evolution. So they got rid of those and they put in, you know, more appropriate science standards. So this is a little victory in Kansas, and again, the eyes of the world have been on Kansas over this issue, because so much, there's been so much back and forth.
I think it's a little more than little, though, because this is the first time that I'm aware that they kind of morphed into their new subtle attack on evolution to teach the controversy, which is important, that some scientists think that this is somewhat significant because this is a more subtle attack and science prevailed.
Well, it's their wedge. It's the thin edge of the wedge, and they
right. And
it's,
and this
it
was
much.
The thinnest part yet, and we still won.
Yeah, which was not trying to promote anything positive, just introduce criticism of evolution, and that got shut down. That's right. So it's a milestone. It's worth mentioning. You know, it's not a Supreme Court case. It's one school board, one state. It could be turned over again in 2 years, which seems to be the pattern in Kansas.
It's also not 10-0.
Yeah, it was a slim margin. It was 6-4.
The first thing I thought about was, who were these other four people?
Right.
What?
Larry, Moe, Curley, and Shemp.
All these Kansas votes have all been 5-4, 6-4, you know, close. They've all been close.
Well, here's a quote that jumped out at me. John Calvert, retired attorney, accused the board of promoting atheism. And Greg Lassie, a retired Wichita area biology teacher, said, "The new standards undermine families by discrediting parents who reject materialism and the ethics and morals it fosters."
Right. That's what it's all about. It's about that. Evolution is evil. It promotes bad morals. That's what the preachers are teaching.
The atheists. There's that dirty word again.
Michael Shermer said, "By all rights, by the description of the procreationist people, like scientists should be out, you know, causing havoc and mayhem in the streets,
absolutely,
and raping altar boys and these sorts of things,
other sordid crimes."
Can you imagine being in the room where these discussions are happening? You know, there's a ton of people from the town there, and
that'd be fun.
It would be interesting to go take a look at it, but just imagine what's going on. I mean, there's basically, the room is divided, and you have the believers and the non-believers, and they're just going at it tooth and nail.
In my head, it will always look like Inherit the Wind.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
That's a Broadway show now. Did you guys
it's
know that?
It's just stuck in the air.
Oh, yeah, it's
it?
Been for many, many years.
Oh, I didn't know that. I just found
the
out.
The movie now play about the Scopes Monkey Trial. In,
yeah.
Was that 1920s?
Do you people, I mean, if I was in there, so, do you realize this is the Board of Education, not the Board of Theology?
Right.
Get out.
Take that.
You know, actually, on a related story, I don't have the full details on this, but I did read a quick press release about a scientist who is holding a course to basically teach scientists how to get onto school boards. So, which is a really good idea to try to, you know, basically pack the school boards
excellent.
With scientists who could actually promote a, you know, scientific agenda in education.
Might have something to say about the science curriculum?
Yeah, because that's how else are we going to get a good science curriculum unless we have scientists who are willing to do their part to promote the public understanding of science and education. So
we often talk about whether or not we should or should not discuss religion. This is a clear example of when religion crosses the line, because all this anti-evolution stuff is pure religiosity. That's where it comes from.
But this is the poster child for religion stomping on science, as you say. This is the issue we always say this represents what we will go after.
Right.
Absolutely. There's another bit of good news, which what I think is of as good news. The Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Laboratory, but goes by the acronym of PAIR, is closing its doors. And Bob, you did some background research on this. Why don't you tell us about it?
Yes, as Steve said, the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Laboratory, shouldn't that be PEARL instead of PEAR? But that's closing after...
What's the PEAR Laboratory?
Okay. PEARs before the swines.
I'll refer to it as PEARL. So PEARL is closing after 27 years. This month, I believe. One website said next spring. Another one said this February, so one or the other. Robert John founded the laboratory. He's a former dean of the School of Engineering and Applied Sciences, and an expert in rocket propulsion. So he's a rocket scientist. He launched...
wow. But he's no brain surgeon.
He launched PAIR to test for and characterize unexplained phenomena generated by the interaction of humans and machines. He said, John said that the lab, with its aging equipment and dwindling finances, has done what it needed to do. If people don't need us after all the results we've produced, then they never will. He was able over the years to raise more than $10 million in private donations over the years.
Jeez.
And at one time employed as many as 7 full-time researchers and generated mountains of data, including millions of trials from random number generators. A typical experiment at PAIR had a subject sitting in front of an electric box flashing numbers just above or below 100. Someone from the staff would yell to the person to either think high or think low, and they watch the display. So John's conclusion after all these years is that the anomalous phenomena are real, can be studied scientifically in large data sets, and could be used in applications. Now, according to an AP article I read, PAIR researchers concluded that the people could alter the results in such machines about, now get this, 2 or 3 times out of 100,000. John claimed if the human mind could slightly alter a machine, it might be able to be used in other areas of human life, such as healing disease. Now, 2 or 3 times out of 100,000, that is so underwhelming, it just blew me away. Now,
how can you even gauge that?
Well, I've got another take on that, though, and just as a conclusion to this part, of course, this has drawn ridicule from Princeton's mainstream scientific community and professional skeptics like James Randi. At the Skeptic Dictionary, though, there's another take on that assessment. Dean Radin and Roger Nelson assessed the data collected by John and his colleagues, and they looked at over 14 million trials. That's a lot of trials by 33 subjects. 33 subjects over a 7-year period, and they found that their subjects performed at the 50.02% level, with, of course, 50%, 50.00 being expected by chance. Now, according to Dean Radin, who wrote The Conscious Universe, The Scientific Truth of Psychic Phenomena, he said that the odds against this happening by accident were beyond 1 trillion to 1. Now, that might sound a little bit more impressive than 2 or 3 out of 100,000. But the other point to conclude from this, though, is that, okay, say, just say he plugged it in the equations properly and he did everything right, and the odds are beyond a trillion to one. Even if,
yeah, but Bob, just quickly, that's because they're doing millions of trials.
Right, well,
that's why. That's how you get to those kind of statistics.
Right, but is 50.02%? Is that a significant level? But one key though is that people will say, all right, a trillion to one. But you know, this is kind of like a false dichotomy. Do you then conclude that psi is at work? I mean, can you say, well, it's got to be, you know, some paranormal phenomenon?
Right.
But what people don't realize is that you have to, before you can possibly make that conclusion, you have to exclude all the other possibilities, and there are numerous ones. There's numerous examples of cheating by subjects. You have to exclude fraud by scientific investigators, sloppy controls, inadequate protocols, poor record keeping, file drawer effects, drawing grand conclusions from single or small studies, misusing statistics. Now, these aren't just failings of studies by paranormalists. These are found in all sciences. This happens all the time, everywhere, and you have to exclude those before you can even approach, you know, contemplating that it's psi.
Anyone would get sloppy after the 10 or 12 millionth trial, you know. You start to get a little lazy.
Hey, Bob, I've got a question for you.
Shoot.
Let's say that it's true that they can affect the machine's outcome a few times every 100,000 times, right?
Right.
What are you going to do with it? Okay, to what end? Great.
What you'd have to do is you'd have to see 100,000 patients, and there'd be like two or three chances in that group that you might affect their, you know, their health. So that's what is that the application that they're talking about?
They're mostly
focused on trying to use this to better the health of humanity, but
right. Well, those two or three would be sent to the secret psionic labs.
Right.
They're secret. You don't know
if they
about
took
them.
That $14 million and sent four or five people to medical school, they would have done a lot of much more good.
One last take on this. Now, part of this, the apparatus that they're using, it's a random number generator. You know, generating random numbers is a key. It's a fundamental part of this. Now, I did a little bit of research on random number generators, and I remember reading long ago that it's fundamentally impossible to produce truly random numbers on any deterministic device. I got a great quote from John von Neumann. He says that anyone who considers arithmetical methods of producing random digits is, of course, in a state of sin. So I just wonder, and I haven't read any other takes on this, I wonder if just because their random number generator is not perfect, which it can't be, maybe that could explain for some of this deviation. So I'm just throwing that out there. If anybody's more knowledgeable about that, please send us an email.
The bottom line is we're talking about a 0.02% variance. You know, when you're doing any kind of research that deals with people, and you come up with your treatment group and your control group, and it's 50.02 to 49.98, that's negative. That's they basically documented to a high degree of precision the absolute absence of extrasensory perception. That's what they showed. But because they did so many trials, they can give that 0.02% the appearance of statistical significance. It's really all just mathematical ledger domain. It's nonsense. But you're right, Jay. There's, you know, there's no practical application to such a small, minuscule effect. But that's not the point. The point is to say that no matter how small the effect is, it's an effect. Therefore, psi exists. And therefore, we could use this data set to justify all of the other psi beliefs and claims that we make. And that's how it's used. That's how it's used by Dean Radin. That's how it's used by all the woo-woo people. You go on these shows, there is, you know, peer-reviewed published research showing that psi exists. So that becomes their starting point. They don't tell you that it's a 0.02%. You know, variance over millions of trials.
So, Steve, then can we take it to the next step and say, and they're doing it because it pays their check? You know, it gives them a paycheck?
Because they're believers.
That's why. You know, started with their conclusion.
It's always good to go into these experiments.
They could have given up a long time ago. Having proved the absence of any kind of
psi effect.
But
that's a big thing. It's a big road to go down just because you just happen to believe, well, I believe that psi exists, so therefore I'm going to dedicate, you know, X number of years of my life and millions of dollars of donated money to come up with this stupid little statistic that's meaningless.
They don't just believe. They believe fervently. They're true believers. And I mean, if you really truly believe that there was something that amazing out there and that you could get evidence of it, you would too. I would. Right. I would dedicate my life to that. That's some crazy stuff that I'd love to see.
You have to think also for a scientist, most scientists spend their careers doing competent research that is, you know, gets buried in this enormous stack of published research. They contribute to this overall process, but they don't really make a huge famous name for themselves, make a lot of money, you know, get Nobel Prizes. Only, you know, the very elite get those kinds of, that kind of recognition. But you have thousands of working scientists, you know, that all would like to have that kind of recognition, that would like to make the world-altering breakthrough discovery. So people who get involved with this research, even if they may start out being earnest, they think that, hey, they're going to change the physics textbooks. And it's kind of hard to get to the point where you accept that it's come to nothing and you have to accept a mediocre career. In fact, a lot of scientists, when they get into their 50s and they've had maybe a respectable, competent, but ultimately mediocre career, that's when they're very vulnerable to shifting over into this woo-woo stuff. Because then they think that they're, you know, they fool themselves into thinking that they're on to something really paradigm changing, something really breakthrough, and they become a true believer, and they can't let it go because now their life's work is sort of wrapped up in this being real.
Okay,
you know? And
kind
I think
like
that's probably
a being thing, you know.
Yeah,
legacy, crap. Legacy. Yep.
Yeah.
Right. They start to think about their legacy as a scientist, and they go off on the deep end. You know.
That's for sure.
One more news item: the Los Angeles Zoo has paid $4,500 to a feng shui expert.
They overpaid.
In order to help design their monkey cages.
I would have done it for free.
According to the principles of feng shui.
Well, it does make perfect sense, Steve, because, you know, humans and monkeys share a common ancestor, and...
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, the...
That's what they say. They say we have to hope Darwin was right and that monkeys are close enough to people that the feng shui principles for people will hold true for monkeys,
I love how they pull in some real science and try to, you know, get some credibility.
Simona Mainini is the woman that got the $4,500 graft out of the L.A. Zoo. I called him up at Steve's request, actually. I tried to get some comment from them, but they have not yet returned my call. I'll let you know if they do in the future.
Yeah, I'd like to see how the LA Zoo defends this total waste of money. You know, they should be spending taking care of these animals.
I wonder if they would spend that much on the bird cages.
Right. She recommended things like moving the door in one of the observation towers, and she said that the energy around the observation tower was very harsh. And so that a water feature should be put in the enclosure to, quote, soften with moisture the harsh energy, unquote.
Yeah, in the those area harsh energies, tower. Perry, I'm telling you, you got to watch out. Those harsh energies will knock you down.
Should buy an over-the-counter harsh energy softener or something.
Very serious.
I could just imagine her walking in and saying, and you know, you might want to think about spreading the feces in that corner.
You can only sweep them. You have to sweep the feces to the circle at the center of the room.
Exactly. Build it up into a pyramid, which will focus your energies. See,
your
I could
fecal energy?
There was a quote from the article. Charles Mays said, we thought it would be more authentic if we went the extra step and made sure it was done with good feng shui. And I just love the idea of good versus bad feng shui.
And just for our listeners who may not know, feng shui is a Chinese, you know, tradition whereby you arrange pieces of furniture in a room or the way the doors and windows of a house are laid out, etc., in order to promote a positive flow of energy.
Of chi.
Yes.
Yeah, like
it's not just chi, it's like good luck and health and finances, whatever. You want like positive luck energy flowing north into your house. You know, it's basically complete and utter magical thinking nonsense. Penn and Teller, you know, did a good show on this. I mean, they're covering all the good stuff like this on their Showtime show bullshit. And, you know, they hired three feng shui consultants to give a consultation on the same room, and they were completely and totally different. I mean, there's no validity in between. So they're not even the nonsense doesn't even match up with the other nonsense.
Well, one was good feng shui, and the other ones were bad feng shui.
This is the Los Angeles Zoo. I mean, this is a major metropolitan zoo. You know, you would think that they would have scientific people.
It is California, though. We do have to. This is California. This is pretty close to the epicenter of woo-woo-ness in the multiverse.
Still.
Your feng shui is as good as my feng shui.
There's something, I know that my gut is telling me I should really despise this, but there's something just really funny about this to me.
But golden monkey feng shui.
I just picture a bunch of people, this is funny, it just cracks me up. Just think of it this way, there's a bunch of people sitting around, not thinking scientifically what would be good for the monkeys. Like, we definitely need it to be clean, we need them to have this amount of space, because this is what, you know, psychologically it would be good for them. But they're thinking more like, okay, there's a doorway that we've got to move, and that tree should be a foot and a half in that direction. And, you know, they're thinking of things that the monkeys will, it'll never occur to them, any of these things.
And
never.
We move the window, Bobo will come into good fortune.
Yeah, and they're taking it seriously. It just seems like a slapstick comedy to me. Like, I could see Benny Hill doing
it kind
this.
Kind of is.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You almost can't make fun of it. It's it's so ridiculous. There's nothing you could do to satirize it or to make fun of it.
I don't know. I think mentioning feces was
it's unbelievable.
The monkeys are smarter than this feng shui person.
Couldn't be dumber. Well, there were quite a few news items this week, so unfortunately, we do not have time to go into any email. And we do want to leave time to continue our series of TAM 5 interviews. This week, we have interviews with columnist Christopher Hitchens and also creator of South Park, Matt Stone. So let's go to those interviews now.
So we're joined now by Christopher Hitchens. Thank you so much for spending some of your time here with us.
It's an honor.
I just enjoyed the talk you just gave, which has a lot to do with media integrity. What do you think are the sort of the most important things, most important values for someone in your line of work?
Well, I should say what I think is the problem with my profession, as I'll generally
That's
call
good.
It. I mean, the journalistic profession and the media as an industry. Everyone has learned to say the words celebrity culture, for example, and to be wised up about that. And so everyone thinks they've seen through it, but I don't think actually people do quite realize what it entails, as well as a lot of boring stuff about some fairly mediocre people, which takes up a lot of space. What it consists of is in judging people's actions by their reputations, not mm-hmm. their reputations by their actions, which is the first job of anyone who wants to be even remotely, I'm using traditional terms for our trade, objective, mm-hmm. detached, impartial, scrupulous, even-handed. You don't just take someone at their own face value. Mm-hmm. You ask a few questions. Well, that's gone now. If someone can be described as a moderate Republican, they're a moderate Republican for life. Mm-hmm. Saudi Arabia used to be described, still is, as the moderate Arab state. Why was that? Once you've got it called that, half the job is done. Mark Twain used to say, get a man a reputation as an early riser, he can sleep till noon. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason why I mention this, apart from the fact that I think it's important in itself, is that it's very true when it comes to discussions of faith. Mm-hmm. It is assumed that if someone says, well, I personally am a man or woman of faith, that's a positive remark they've just made.
Right.
And entitles them to deferential nods and, you know, sincere looks and, you know, slight... That this expression that I'm making that won't go on the radio.
Right.
Of yes, quite. You know, very good. That's good. We wouldn't have been happy if you hadn't said that.
Right.
Completely uncritical, unanalytical, and thus you can get utterly bogus reputations, such as the most famous media star of the fundamentalist fanatic group ever, Mother Teresa. Mm-hmm.
Right. And of course, you wrote the brilliant Missionary Position, which everyone needs to read.
Well, it's nice of you to say that. I mean, the surprise to me about the book was, it's really only a pamphlet, was that it was the first and only time that anyone had ever tried anything but 100% favorable Niagara publicity
right.
for her.
Right.
And the shock that one would even try that, one would do the ABC of the journalist's job. Is it all true, what we've heard about this person? The very first thing any reporter should ask themselves. It was as if I had done something absolutely transgressive.
It was inconceivable, almost blasphemy.
In fact, well, my admirers even said quite falsely, it was a very brave thing to do. It's an elementary thing to do. Mm-hmm. When invited on to discuss it, which was very, very seldom, I would always be in the green room, sort of quarantined, and always on the air. They'd say, well, of course, that was just a very individual presentation by Mr. Hitchens and so on, as if...
They distance themselves.
We feel we can't have it said that we never had anyone on ever once who had a different opinion, but even when we do, we're going to make it clear it's a very special occasion, a departure from practice. Well, then you might as well say you're not in the journalism business. Mm-hmm.
How difficult was it for you to turn over those the people who could tell you all about exactly what Mother Teresa was all about? Because there was at least one nun I know that you talked to who was incredibly damning. How hard was it to find her?
Well, a lot of what happens with journalism, on any subject, by the way, is that you write something, and only then do you hear from the people you should have been interviewing. I mean, that's why we call it the first draft. Mm-hmm. You put something out, then they know who to write to. So I had already heard from people who had gone out idealistically to work for the missionaries of charity, so-called, in Calcutta, and who'd been very shocked by what they'd found. And I put a number of them in my book, and also in a documentary that I made. But many more of them came out of the woodwork, sorry for the cliché, when I published it more, including one very serious young woman who'd become a nun and joined the missionaries of charity in their New York office, and who knew how much money they had in the bank, and she knew why they weren't spending it on the poor, because the money was supposed to go to building convents in honor of Mother Teresa. It wasn't supposed mm-hmm. to be for the alleviation of poverty or illness or mm-hmm. distress. And who couldn't square this with her conscience. They were going around in rags begging when they were banking huge amounts of money, sometimes in checks or in cash form in the bank every day, that they weren't giving to the needy. That was worth having.
It sounds like what you're saying is throughout your career you have noticed that the level of quality of that kind of fact-checking and asking questions has gone down. That things are getting worse within the media in general in terms of their level of overall skepticism?
What the media generally do is they reinforce what people already think. They're not going to ask a question that will make the listener who doesn't understand the question go to the next channel mm-hmm. because they're bored. Maybe there's something more interesting a click away. So the question will be, well, what are we talking about today? I suppose it would be Mrs. Clinton. Mm-hmm. She will not be asked a question that isn't of the form, well, do you think you're really electable? Way to ask a tough question.
Right, right.
Anything more awkward than that, and they're really afraid, apart from anything else, that people wouldn't know what they were talking about. So again, it's a reinforcement. It makes people dumber, and then it takes them as being dumb mm-hmm. and doesn't ask a challenging question. And I think it gets to the point also where those who are hired to ask the questions don't know how to do it.
Do you think that the democratization, if you will, of media with the internet and YouTube and podcasts and everything is alleviating that problem because other people will get the information out even if the mainstream
I'm fairly sure of it. I mean, I've given up. I only read the Washington Post and the New York Times now to find out what other people think is going on. Mm-hmm. Not to find out what's going on myself. I'd be a sap if I did that. I'm actually in a dictionary of quotations online, according to my son, for something I once said, which was that I became a journalist so as I wouldn't have to rely on the press for information. True, too. I mean, those who do, I pity. I read the New York Times to find out what impression its readers are under. So mm-hmm. I'm not, you know, when I meet them later in the day in Washington, I'll know what they think they're talking about. I make up my own newspaper every day, usually from things sent to me by intelligent readers or friends, from everything from YouTube to the Times of India. Mm-hmm. Or Al-Akram in Egypt, or whatever it might be.
That's becoming more the rule and less the exception.
Yeah, but you know, I'm nearly 60 now, and I've read a lot of books, and I've written more books than some people in the profession have read. Mm-hmm. And I was lucky, I've had quite a good education, and I've been doing journalism for a long time. So when this comes at me, I have a sorting process. I don't just think, hey, a new thing from YouTube, I'll put that on the top of my page.
Right.
I do worry about people who are new and fresh and coming to it, thinking, well, how do they know how to sort out the white noise and the junk from the valuable? What process of a word that's gone out of fashion, but I still use, of discrimination do they use? Mm-hmm. That does worry me. Because if people aren't, so to speak, on the same page in the culture, in at least a few ways that we all have rough agreement what we're talking about, what the common culture is, what the common vocabulary, idiom, vernacular is, then it can be a bit worrying. And everyone's sort of atomized, eccentric, expert on everything and nothing. I don't know. But I do know that this is better than taking the old media at their face value.
And why do you think that journalists in general are losing these skills?
Because it's part of the entertainment industry. Yes, and that in turn means taking focus groups on not just on what kind of movies people would want to watch, which has long been going on, and pre-screening them for that purpose, but, which now does happen, what kind of news stories do you want to see? They do that now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's crowd-pleasing. Everything is populism. The assumption is that the people are in charge and thus should get what they want. Mm-hmm. But the parallel assumption, which is partly necessitated by it, is utter contempt for these people on the part of those who are doing it. And how much more easily can we manipulate them today while pretending to flatter them?
Mm-hmm.
Which is actually what populism is. It's an insult to democracy, not a parody of it. In Martin Amis's novel about Fleet Street, about the newspaper business in England, called Yellow Dog, at the editorial conference in the morning, they don't refer to our readers, they refer to our wankers. Without trying to be funny, I mean, matter-of-factly refer to them. We got a few wankers' letters today. Shall we print them or not? You know? But of course, the paper sells itself as the newspaper of the common man and woman,
paper.
The one we stick up for you. In Washington, we lived for a long time, Channel 7 News every night used to have a section of the news program called Channel 7 on Your Side. 7 on Your Side. How can you have a news channel that's on your side?
Yeah, they're openly admitting they're biased.
Yes, but the bias is in favor of
so it's okay.
You, the average citizen, yeah. And your lovely family and your gorgeous children.
Yeah, we were just discussing that. Who were we talking with? We were talking about
Peter Sagal.
Yeah, Peter Sagal. We were talking about how easy it is to seek out something that just confirms your own beliefs these days. It's like we have an incredible array of options to choose from, and we go for exactly what is going to confirm our own beliefs.
Well, we all do that.
Yeah.
And don't spend time on stories that bore us or upset us, perhaps, and we self-select. But most people are willing to be exposed to new ideas and to challenges. In fact, would rather like the idea. It's just that they're not getting that. They're not going to be offered it.
Well, there are opposing viewpoints that you can find. There are let's just take the right and left, for instance. You know, you have your right biased newspaper, your left biased newspaper, but people don't want the right biased if they're already on the left. So it seems to me like we do have a choice. It's just people just aren't choosing to find that stuff.
The problem is not it's not that people will say in Washington not read the Washington Times because it's run by the conservatives, because a lot of liberals do read the Washington Times, because Mao thinks it's quite a well-written paper. And its op-ed pages are a little more various than the Washington Post, which is very bland.
Right.
And rather centrist. It's not that. It's the pretense that when they're reading the New York Times, they're reading a paper that doesn't have a bias.
Hmm.
The affectation of objectivity. People use the word objective as if it meant even-handed or fair-minded or impartial or bipartisan. None of these words mean objective at all. Objective means that in a confrontation with the evidence, you would be willing to change your own mind. And you'll continue to subject yourself to that
implied
challenge. That's what objectivity means. The New York Times presents itself as a paper that has no opinion that you could detect from its reportage. You'd have to go to the editorial page to find out what its collective view was. Well, that's nonsense. I mean, I don't think anyone reading the New York Times can't tell what its collective view of matters is from its quotidian coverage. It's just that that pretense isn't worth having. Fleet Street journalism is often thought to be better for that reason, in that the bias of newspapers in England is undisguised, so that there's no hypocrisy.
Hmm.
There's no fraud.
Well, we have the pleasure of sitting here with Matt Stone, one of the creators of South Park.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
So I think the burning question all of our listeners have that I need to ask up front is, how is it that you guys are just so totally awesome?
Oh, God. Well, there's a very easy answer to that. No, I don't know. I don't know, but that's, you know, coming to this skeptics convention, I guess it is, it's... you know, we're always amazed. Like, we go to the, you know, we came because we're friends of Penn and we're fans of Randy, and that's why we're here.
Yeah.
You know, and so to come to a place and have all these people come up to you and say, like, you know, you mean this much to me, and like, you know, you've spoken to, you know, it's kind of an amazing experience.
Yeah. You didn't know you were a skeptic.
I didn't know I was a skeptic.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I'm saying. I kind of learned afterwards that. Kind of a little bit of a skeptic.
Yeah, I think
so. That's cool.
What you guys need to know, you know, it's obvious from the show. And we watch it. We watched it for a long time. And but we would talk to each other. It's like, you know what? These guys get it. They seem to get it. Yeah. I mean, like when you...
The douchebag episode.
Classic. I mean, that is, it's actually the definitive criticism of cold
of
reading.
Cold reading.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's textbook.
Absolutely.
Well,
a
lot of that came from wanting to make fun of, for me, just watching somebody like... I mean... Is, you know, is coming that whole philosophical question, is there any harm done? If, you know, well, is there any harm done by, you know, pretending to be a psychic? Mm-hmm. And it's just watching people, like, really think that they're talking to their loved one, or that he's talking to their loved one who just died. I'm just like, man, you're
it's
a douche.
Cruel.
Like, that's
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
But then we learned about cold reading after. Like, it's kind of cool doing South Park, being, you know, me and Trey, little geeky, naturally curious people. We... do research stuff, you know. So I found out. I found out about cold reading while doing that show. I didn't know about it before,
right?
You know, and so, and for instance, the atheism episode, this last run, that was like, I mean, I read, I got into that subject.
Yeah,
you know,
you're learning on the job.
Yeah, learning on the job. Yeah. So it's cool like that, you know.
Well, after we all discussed basically the brief that you gave on what cold reading is and how it's bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
And we all were like, it is absolutely perfectly concise. We couldn't have said it better ourselves. And that's what we do. That's what we. That's our number one thing that we do.
How many times? So. I mean, I've written an article about it. I've read other skeptics write about it. But that was just so concise and pithy. Like, wow, that's... It was
it's also now
beautiful.
Now John Edwards is the biggest douche.
Yeah, he's the biggest douche. I love that song at the end.
Biggest douche in the universe.
Matt, are you going to have Saddam on the show still, even after he's gone?
Oh man, I don't know. We were so mad because, you know, we had this idea for a big like a Saddam Hussein execution extravaganza, and we were going to do it last run, and we're like, nah, maybe we'll wait till he gets executed next year, and then it happened, and now I don't know if we can do it.
Well, look, he's in hell.
You bring him back.
Hell,
we can do that. Yeah, maybe we'll just do that.
Bring him back from the dead.
Or every now and then, his head just kind of flops to the side. Got to write it.
He's a good character.
He's finally Satan's bitch now.
Yeah, maybe that's a different way. Yeah.
Another thing, I have so many things I want to get to real quick. First off, the World of Warcraft. The absolute funniest 30 minutes of my life.
So many people
incredible.
Like that.
It's, you obviously did research. I'll admit.
Oh yeah, Trey plays World of Warcraft.
Yeah,
he's not a big.
Oh, okay.
player, but you know, we have about 70 people in our office, and they're all pretty, you know, animation geeks.
Yeah.
And I mean, 68 of them. Play World of Warcraft. I mean, it's a crazy popular game.
We might have played once or twice.
Yeah, but you know, it's really cool too. But like, if you walk around our office, you'll see South Park on screens being animated, and if somebody has a break, they're playing World of Warcraft. So it's like the idea almost came about from like just our office, just walking around our office.
Yeah.
So yeah.
So what was the in your opinion the definitive we went too far moment that you've ever done?
Oh, in South Park?
Yeah.
It's probably that Roman the Bloody Mary show where we had to poke it blood on the face. I was like, wow, that's we can say that we wanted to, you know, make a statement and this and that and the other. At the end of the day, we just was like, I don't think we went too far. I don't think we went too far, but that's about as far as we've gone.
Yeah. Right.
Well, you guys with Catholics a couple of times. I mean, the whole All Hail the Great Queen Spider episode.
Yeah,
the
most well, I mean, that goes back to a fundamental. I you know, as I said on stage, like I'm not, don't consider myself an atheist. Mm-hmm. And if I am in any of it, I don't hate religion. I'm just not there.
Yeah.
But I do hate parts about the Catholic Church. And I mean, that episode.
Sure.
I mean, there's a, you know, when the sex scandal with the little boys, you know, it's just like, come on, guys. You're like, that's just, we got to say something about that. And, you know, it doesn't even really say a whole lot about the doctrine. It just says about that.
I mean, the South
organization of, like, come on,
cool
guys. He's a cool guy. Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, in other words, like, to do an episode and actually say something, you have to figure out what you want to say and quit without just being a dick.
Right.
And just going, yeah, and just like, yeah, look how stupid it is. You know what I mean? It's like very concise. Like, this is what's wrong about that right there, guys.
Right.
And it's actually probably, I don't know, like a Christian criticism of the Catholic Church is almost stronger than a secular one at that point. You know what I mean? If that makes sense? Like, we wanted the priest to be the one to say, this is wrong, instead of, like, somebody outside the church.
Yeah.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, we kind of, we do religion in a lot of different ways.
So, Matt, being that Tom Cruise is my nemesis, what can I do to convince you guys to please continue the decimation of his character?
I don't know if we have to do anything.
What more can be done?
I mean, but, you know, because we do get trapped in that sometimes, but, like, for us, the fun part about South Park is absolutely we do something, we get into it, and then we move on.
Yeah.
You know,
and that makes sense.
And it's important because I get that way too. Like, I want to do like five more atheism episodes, but it's really important for us to, like, we do it, clear the plate, move on.
Spread it out.
Do you have Sylvia Brown in your sights? Is she on your hit list?
No, I just kind of found out about her.
Yeah.
Look at her.
She's in a worst of Edwards.
So much there.
She's good for you.
Yeah. Do you know Sylvia Brown? You know, yeah, we got to figure it out.
That's
what Randy was on
she
TV
told,
last night for, right?
Yeah, the woman, the kid that was just found after four years, she told the family that he was died and that he got killed
and
he was tortured.
And tortured.
Oh, yeah.
Turns out he was alive.
Yeah.
She should be easy mark for you guys. Yeah, I'd like to see that.
Doesn't that suck?
What did you think of the Borat movie?
I loved it.
Wasn't it great?
Yeah, I loved it. Yeah, he's a super duper duper genius, that Borat.
We're getting the high sign over here, so
thanks.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts. Two are genuine and one is fictitious. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics and you listeners at home to see if you could figure out which one is the fake. Everybody ready?
Yep.
Yes.
Absolutely.
All righty. Here we go.
Bring it on.
A new study suggests that chimpanzees have been crafting and using stone tools for thousands of years. Number two, a newly published article claims to have resolved Einstein's famous twin paradox. And item number three, researchers have begun studying the use of magnets to correct sunken chest deformity. Perry, go first.
All right. Now, having tested magnets ourselves, I know they're crap, but this one's got to be true. There's got to be some powerful magnet something in there to pull your chest up. All right. Chimps and tools. Well, psychics use tools, so I suppose chimps could manage it. And, Stephen, what was the second one?
The second one was newly published article claims to have resolved Einstein's famous twin paradox.
So you'd have to actually know what the twin paradox was in order to make a reasonable guess.
Perry, I'll talk to you later.
It helped.
Yeah, I know you would, Bob. Believe
it would help.
Steve, you said that they resolved it?
Yes.
Hold on. Right, so let's the second hear what Perry has to say.
That one is clearly fake. The second one is clearly fake. I read all
because
the research done on twins during the Nazi era, and it's clearly fake.
All right.
Doing the famous Doublemint study of 1998.
It doesn't matter what research I use. I rely on my own sources. Thank you.
All right, Evan, go ahead.
Oh, you're going to make me go to the Akashic file for this one, aren't you? Chimps using stone tools, that seems quite plausible. Resolve the twin paradox or magnets to repair sunken chest deformity syndrome. All right. It's quite obvious that where's my coin? Heads and tails. That I'll agree with Perry. I'll go with Perry and say that they have not resolved the twin paradox. It was
totally
probably
unresolved.
The triple paradox, not the twin paradox.
Of course.
All right, Jay, go ahead.
There's a lot of pressure on me because I don't want to disappoint Mike from the boards. this is so frustrating.
And for those of you just joining us, there's a running bet on Jay catching up to the rest of us in the science or fiction rankings.
Yeah.
Most of us are way, way ahead of it.
It's not looking good.
The only
Come on,
one
Jay, we're counting on you.
I know. It's just the only one that I don't really have any real memory of reading anything about. Like, the magnet thing, I don't know, that strikes a chord. I thought I read something about that. But the twin paradox thing, it doesn't sound right to me.
All right.
So, that's the fake.
Okay. Rebecca, you go.
I'm going to have to side with the peanut gallery. I'm thinking the twin paradox
oh, you said
has
peanut.
Not.
Okay,
hey,
Bob.
I've been called worse things by better people.
Bob.
Okay, chimps crafting tools for thousands of years. Yes, that is true.
That is true.
Oh, from the head chimp himself.
Thank you, Dr. Leakey.
My left leg is a superconductor. Einstein's twin paradox. I've always liked that paradox. One problem, though, is that I didn't know that it really was a paradox. I thought they pretty much resolved it, and they did have an explanation for it. But apparently somebody came up with another way to deal with it. That is true. Magnets correcting sunken chest deformity, that is false.
Okay. So you all agree that a new study suggests that chimpanzees have been crafting and using stone tools for thousands of years.
God, I hope that's fiction now.
That is fiction. You're all wrong.
Yes.
Woo-hoo!
Now, Steve, have you ever fooled us all before?
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
What are you talking about?
Okay, wait a minute, because I read that.
I know, I'm sure you did, but you didn't listen carefully. I made this
apparently
a little tougher.
I said,
you have to listen carefully to the details. A new study suggests that chimpanzees have been crafting and using stone tools for thousands of years. They haven't
that was
ever.
Very crafty,
they're not
doctor.
Crafting. They've been using stone tools for thousands of years, probably.
Oh my!
Not crafting
God.
Them.
They went to the hardware store.
So what happened?
Them.
The Snap-on truck drove
There's
by.
No evidence that they've ever modified any stone tools.
Steve, there. Some of the researchers did think that they actually made them because they were suggesting that they hadn't had contact with humans, but other researchers were saying that they had contact with humans in the form of hunters as opposed to farmers.
Yeah, and they wear perfume.
Well, you're right, but that was talking about whether or not humans might have taught the chimpanzees how to use the stones. In other words, they were mimicking humans. And the point of that was that the chimpanzees have probably been doing it for so long that they were doing it without having learned it from people. In fact, it's possible that the common ape ancestor between humans and chimps used stone tools, chimps and human ancestors have been doing it since that split about 5 million
That's
years ago.
True.
The evidence is just, finding basically bits of crushed nuts and stuff on stones. Mm-hmm. But the stones are not crafted. They are not modified.
There's also that tool that's long and curved and sharp for de-beaking birds that that's been around since the Egyptian times.
You're right.
So you
I admit, guys,
you tricked
that
word
was
wrong.
I admit that was tough. I admit
that was very
tricky. It was tricky.
Tricky.
But the crafting, that was big. Now, newly published article claims to have resolved Einstein's famous twin paradox. Again, this is a tricky one, but because you have to really listen to how I state things. Newly published article claims. That is true. This one is true. However, a lot of people think that this guy's full of it, that this is bunk, because as Bob said, the paradox really isn't that much of a paradox. Now, this is an LSU professor. So this is the Louisiana State University professor of physics, and he published this in the International Journal of Theoretical Physics, which is a peer-reviewed journal, basically stating that the twin paradox. So here's the twin paradox really quickly. Mm-hmm. If Einstein's theory of relativity says that if someone's traveling close to the speed of light, that time for them will slow down. Mm-hmm. And this has been verified. Clocks, traveling at different speeds, you can measure a difference in these atomic clocks that are very, very sensitive. The paradox is this. If you have one twin who goes on a spaceship and flies away from the Earth, and the other twin stays behind, the twin that flies away from the Earth comes back after traveling close to the speed of light. Say for them, they've been traveling for 5 years. When they get back, their twin will be 10 years older. The paradox is, if speed is all relative, then why is it that the twin that went on the rocket trip and came back is the one for whom time is slowed and not the twin who stays behind? Because to either twin, the other one is moving away and coming back. All motion is relative. Now, I too was under the impression that this really isn't a paradox, because the solution is that the twin that is under acceleration is the one that experiences the time dilation effects. The twin that's going on the rocket ship has to accelerate to a certain speed and then slow down, turn around, reaccelerate, and slow down again. And that's that acceleration that causes, that's the asymmetry in the twin, in the between the two twins, and that accounts for it. Now, on the PhysOrg message board, this is, just a lot of physics geeks talking about this. The article's getting ripped to shreds. There most people basically saying that this really isn't a paradox, so what's this guy talking about? And I'm not sure what the ultimate answer is going to be. This guy's saying that his point is that you have to look at the relative motions, not just with respect to each other, but with respect to the distant stars. And again, I am not sure. I don't know enough theoretical physics to know.
I mean, that seems
if
like
that makes sense or not.
Yeah, I know. You're right, but that seems like a decent way to just another way to spot the asymmetry in the two. Because
yes.
If you using that as a background, you could see that asymmetry would be in your face.
But so, I don't think it's necessary.
True. You're right about it. It may be true, and he found another way of looking at it that works. But it may just be redundant, you know, to what's been worked out before. You're right, and that seems to be the reaction to this article. But we'll keep an eye on it and see what the final, you know, result is. But this was published in a peer-reviewed, you know, Journal of Theoretical Physics. So I thought that was interesting. The third one is pretty straightforward.
Steve?
Yes.
Before we go to the third one, can we just go back to the chimps for a mere moment?
Let's go back to the chimps.
Sure. I have the article from Live Science in front of me.
Oh, we're still
arguing.
The
very first sentence is, chimpanzees learn to make and use stone tools on their own rather than copying humans, new evidence suggests.
Well, I'm reading the press release from the Max Planck Society, so this is... I think that Live Science article,
you know,
is not accurate.
If you're going
to the
do
original
an argument from
report.
Authority by quoting Max Planck,
so I'm saying this is the original. I think you're reading an interpretation of the press release. I'm going to the more original source. Doesn't mention anything about making, working, crafting, just using them.
I am going to officially protest this science of fiction.
Okay. You should.
Yes, God forbid you be wrong yet this year. You're right. I agree.
So, Steve, not only do we have to scan these news articles, we have to read and understand them. Is that what you're saying?
it is a little outrageous.
Twin Peaks and
I'm
monkey
perfectly fine
tools.
Getting it wrong.
Oh, this is awful.
All right, well, I will look deeper into that and happily revise the results if there's actual evidence that they crafted stone tools. All right, the third one is, researchers have begun studying the use of magnets to correct sunken chest deformity. This one's true, of course. So what they're basically doing is attaching a powerful magnet to the chest, the sternum, and then using an external magnet to provide a constant pulling on it in order to force the bones. So basically, the sunken chest deformity is as it sounds. The connection between the ribs and the sternum are malformed so that the chest has a very deep sunken in appearance. So they're trying to basically just pull it out. And the magnets are being used to apply a constant
pressure.
Like a
dented car.
Yeah, I know a few girls that could use that treatment.
Jay.
There's quicker ways of achieving the results you're interested in, Jay.
Hey, Jay, if you want the tits bigger, just blow more air in.
Oh, nice.
Oh, 2 points. Blow more air in, she says.
That's amazing.
That was actually good.
That was pretty good.
That was very good.
Very good, Rebecca.
All right, so I had a clean sweep this week, but contesting the chimpanzees working the stone tool or crafting the stone tools, but we will get confirmation on that for next week. Evan,
hi.
Please give us the results of last week's puzzle.
Last week's puzzle, in fact, was a number sequence: 10, 1, 5, 25, 50. And there were quite a few correct answers on this one. The first one to get it correct, though, was Jared Zimmerman. So congratulations. From the United Kingdom, I might add. And he realize that is the ascending size of U.S. coinage between 1 cent and 50 cents.
Oh, very nice.
This puzzle wasn't without its...
Controversy?
Well, I wouldn't say it's so much controversy, but a few people, you know, had some interesting things to chime in about it. You know, most I think people were, well, curious as to why I would do a puzzle which is simply based on U.S. coins, and that would put everyone else in the world other than U.S. citizens to a disadvantage. And I guess there's something to be said for that. I mean, the real reason I did it...
It's probably because you're from the United States.
It could have something to do with
that. I'm just guessing here.
The real reason I threw that puzzle in was just to kind of break up the string of puzzles a bit, just to make something that was more based on logic, obviously.
Yeah, more mathematical.
Right. Something, you know, instead of just another skeptical-based puzzle. But I wanted to try again this week. I'm going to do another numerical series puzzle.
While you're talking about the controversy, didn't a few people point out that there are... dollar denomination coinage that's actually smaller than the 50 cent piece. Zach, could you weigh a dollar is smaller than a 50 cent piece?
Yeah, it is. But actually, I purposefully left dollar out of it because
I stopped at 50.
Exactly. So I purposefully left the dollar amount out because I felt it would have been too easy at that point. A little too recognizable. So really, it's the series of coins between the values of 1 and 50.
Right.
Is the actual
I guess, official okay. answer to that puzzle. But I'm going to do another one this week, and then next week I'm going to go back to doing more, you know, skeptical-based word puzzles and so forth. But I want to see if people can identify this number sequence. So here's this week's puzzle. 0.0, 2.6, 23.4, 25.2, 3.1, 26.7, 97.8, and 28.3. So that is that should be some. It's a sequence that would be recognized by anybody in the world. It is not country specific.
Evan, that was a good puzzle, good. Man. I'm puzzled. So it's
well, think about it, and you know, try to come up with the answer. Enjoy.
That's what we try to do. What's the point, isn't it?
Evan, you also sent me the quote this week, so why don't you go ahead and read the quote for us?
So this week's quote is as such. I believe in evidence. I believe in observation, measurement, and reasoning confirmed by independent observers. I'll believe anything, no matter how wild and ridiculous, if there is evidence for it. The wilder and more ridiculous something is, however, the firmer and more solid the evidence will have to be. That was said by Isaac Asimov, and he was replying to the question that was asked of him, don't you believe in anything? And that was his answer.
That's a great reply.
Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence.
Yes, the skeptic's mantra.
He was a cool dude. I liked him. That's
right. Yeah, it's unfortunate. I never got to meet him. It's one of my regrets.
I can channel him for you.
Well, that is our show for this week. Thanks again, everyone, for joining
us. Thank you, Steve. Yeah. Thanks for doing it from vacation, Steve.
Yeah.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah, enjoy Florida.
Yeah. I will. I got a few more days before I have to return to the Arctic chill back in New England.
Steve, before you cut it off, I just want to let the listeners know I'm going to be in Maui the first week of March. If anybody has any good ideas of something I could research out there while I'm away, I'd be really happy to do it. I'm going to have a lot of free time, so it'd be really cool to come up with something that I can look into.
All our Maui listeners, write in.
Some Maui listeners.
Of course we do.
Jay is going to debunk Maui pseudoscience.
That's all right. There you go.
Aloha.
Excellent.
Jay, I got one for you. When I was there years ago, what's the main volcano on Maui? It's Haleakala.
Wanahakalubi.
I remember when I was there in '89, Haleakala at the top. There's lots of lava everywhere from previous flows, and they said do not take any lava, any hardened lava, because you know their whole what's their lava god Pele. You're not allowed to take it, and they said that they get mailed back. I don't know how pounds and pounds, maybe even tons of this lava every year, because people take it and then they, of course, they experience bad luck, which must be because they took it and they mail
the
it back.
Brady Bunch episode that is lame,
right?
Oh my!
So of course
that was the tiki.
So of course I had to take some. Even in '89, I took a chunk.
Bob, that's why you went bald. Oh yeah. God, you shouldn't have done it.
Right, but so I still have that and. I'm very glad I took it.
Wait, is it possible that maybe they tell you that because they really don't want you to take the lava
island away, right?
For some natural reason.
Well, the starch. They don't want you to take the island away. It's an island. Okay, I'll be there. I'll be eating.
All right, Jay. You report back when that's in March you're talking about.
Yeah, and also for all of our listeners, right. I'm not going anywhere warm. Yeah, I'm here in freezing cold Boston for the rest of my goddamn life. Sorry, I just got a little bitter.
It'll build character, believe.
Well, until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. Please send us your questions, suggestions, and other feedback. You can use the Contact Us page on our website, or you can send us an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission. Endless delays.